Welcome to another BYU Sports Nation Deep Blue Special. I'm your host, Spencer Linton. Great to have you with us in Studio B. Over the next hour, we will introduce you to, and in some instances, reintroduce you to some unforgettable, powerful, and impactful stories. Over the last few years, BYU TV has explored, discovered, and produced these inspiring and unique narratives, often featuring BYU athletes and coaches, but have now expanded the search into the realms of conference opponents. These stories are at the heart of our Deep Blue series. Today, we will focus on some transcendent women and their stories of loss, hope, faith, and love. Five outstanding women, each one with their own powerful story to tell. BYU basketball center Heather Hampson will tip things off today as she shares the process of carving her own path at BYU while following her record-setting mom and sisters in Provo. This is Deep Blue with Heather Hampson.
Teresa Spalding Hampson, one of the best players to come through here.
She was a four-time All-American at BYU. She holds the school record in block shots.
She also played overseas after she was done with that.
Jen Hampson, absolutely. I mean, an All-American in volleyball and in basketball. Like, you don't see that a ton.
I don't think BYU knew what was coming at them when she came.
I should have trusted my mom from the beginning, but I don't know why I always fought her opinion for the longest time, but she was right. I absolutely loved it. Loved playing basketball and volleyball. And then, you know, my siblings always came to games.
Watching Jen play was really cool. She was dominant.
And she sort of set her parameters and she went and took both sports, took the basketball program as far as they'd ever been to the Sweet 16, and then took volleyball to the finals, to the championship match.
Even Sarah, she was a big force here.
Sarah played for the volleyball team and the basketball team. On the basketball team is where she really shined. And she challenged Teresa for the block shot record, and Sarah went in to try and see if she could best Jen.
And then there's me, living my best life. I mean, growing up, I was always a perfectionist. I wanted everything to be perfect, and I wanted to be the perfect person and live up to the family expectation of doing good in school and in sports.
That has hampered her because the perception, yeah. Right? There's 6'7" mom, there's 6'7" Jen, there's 6'6" Sarah, and here comes 6'3" Heather. Oh, she's short, even if she is a Hampson. Doesn't really look like a Hampson. Is she really a Hampson? You know, we spend endless days answering fans, yep, that really is one of ours.
Growing up, it was just kind of shoved in my face of like, well, you're not tall, so like, what are you gonna do? How are you gonna be different?
I think it was really difficult for me as a parent to see it going on and not really knowing how to help. And a child doesn't always come to you, and a child doesn't always respond to you as a parent telling them, well, you're really good. She would make comments like, well, mom, you're supposed to love me. You know, you're supposed to think I'm wonderful. You're supposed to think all of these things, but she didn't think of that way herself.
Wanting to be perfect was still such a mental strain on me during school. And so that just kind of made myself isolate myself from everyone. It just, I need to focus on being the best in my sports and in school. But because of that, I was just so depressed and had so much anxiety and was not in a good place mentally my senior year.
In high school, we realized that it could be debilitating for her and it could cause some things where she just wasn't moving and going where she wanted to go.
Having a mental breakdown every other day, that was normal. And so I remember my mom, you know, nudged me. She's like, hey, how you doing? Do you want to go talk to someone? I'd be like, what are you talking about? I'm fine. Like, I don't need help. And then I remember the turning point, I think, was when I was in the car with Sarah and she talked to me and she was like, hey, you're not doing good. You should go listen to mom, like go to therapy. And she's like, this isn't normal. If you're happy, you wouldn't be breaking down all the time. And so I was like, okay.
You know, I think it's important to talk a little bit about mental health as well. And I think that it's been something that people don't like to talk about sometimes. And I think that when they hear that it's okay and accept it and those kinds of things.
After about like 2 months of going, I started to see a big improvement. It was really helpful because I was going into summer term for college coming up. And so I think I probably wouldn't have survived if I was still in that mental state coming out of high school.
time came to make decisions about college. You know, Heather's playing high school volleyball and basketball, starring on both teams, doing really well, getting offers to play both volleyball and basketball at a variety of schools. But BYU was not nibbling.
I wanted to play at BYU, and so I think that kind of was hard, though, because I didn't really have a backup plan if BYU didn't work.
That's just her dream, and that's what she wanted to do. And so that's what she did. She went after it.
And Coach Judkins said, okay, we'll take a chance on you. Don't know if you're really any good, but we'll take a chance. I'll let you be a walk-on.
She redshirted her first year, which I thought was smart. Again, another sacrifice where you're never going to get on the court and you're a walk-on. So you're signing up for just being a practice player.
And she worked really, really hard for Jetty and made great progress and did some great things.
She earns everything that she's gotten. She's earned a scholarship from me for the last 2 years, and I love that she just comes to work every day. She's the first one in the gym, the one on the days off, making sure she's getting shots up, so she's always working to get somewhere.
Even though everybody expects this, you know, all-American approach to it because of who her family has been in the past.
Whether she's the tallest in her family or the smallest, it really doesn't matter because of what she adds to our team.
There's a price to be paid to win, and Heather Hampson continually pays that price and does what it takes to be successful. So there's no doubt in my mind that on the court, off the court, success is gonna follow her.
I think that in the last year, I've seen leaps and bounds with her. She's just been far more willing to take those risks and work hard to get where she wants to be and gain that confidence.
For a while, I was just accepted the fact that I'm just a Hampson, and that's all I'll ever be, and I am, and I'm proud of that. But I am Heather Hampson. I am my own person, and I think it's important that we all recognize everyone as who they are and not group them with whatever we might categorize them in.
Heather has undoubtedly added her own flair to the legendary Hampson legacy at BYU and just wrapped up her junior season in the spring of 2024 with big aspirations of helping BYU women's hoops take that next step in Big 12 play. Long before BYU's inclusion in the Big 12 Conference, BYU cross country had already established itself as a major player in the national running scene. BYU star Sarah Musselman played her own large role in that, but ran for more than just titles. She ran for solace following tragedy. On those several paths, the All-American found, yes, success, and overwhelming support at BYU. This is Deep Blue.
So my first year at BYU, I wanted to get every good kid in the state of Utah. All of the visits that I had done prior to going to Sarah's house were pretty similar. The houses looked the same, the family life looked the same, and I think that's why Sarah's visit struck out to me as so different. It was like, wow, this man is raising this high school daughter. When I got up after a couple hours and walked to the door, I reached for the doorknob and he kind of grabbed my hand, my wrist, and said, I've done the best I can with her. Please help her.
My mom struggled with a lot of pain in her life that she never dealt with, she never confronted.
It almost kind of seemed like Monticello, it was a small town, so everyone knew everyone's business, right? So once we kind of got out of Monticello and got into Idaho and nobody really knew the family, nobody really knew us, I would say that like my mom kind of got a little bit of sense of freedom in a way. Like I think that's when her struggle showed a little bit more. They weren't so in her anymore.
And then my oldest sister actually had a stillborn. And I think that that loss really started triggering things within her as well.
Say if the kids had a surgery or something, then she was always in charge of the, you know, pain pills or anything like that. And I would notice that they're going down a bit, you know what I mean? And so she was doing a little bit of that, and then, of course, a little bit of alcohol. And
my mom struggling with this, my dad was so consumed with trying to help her get out of this, but she kind of had to figure that out on her own but didn't know how to. And so it affected them in a way of just kind of ending up consuming the two of them in their own little world, trying to figure their own stuff out. And reasonably so. I think my dad loved my mom so much that he was just trying to do everything he could. But it also ended up turning very unhealthy. My sister Sadie and I went through the thick of it together. We saw the scratches on my dad's face. We saw my mom arrested on the curb. We saw a lot of things that I would not wish on my worst enemy. I saw that Sarah was strong, but I also saw that the life we were handed was heavy for her. I don't want people to think that my mom was this horrid person, because she had amazing qualities. She was an amazing mom. She was an amazing mom that got consumed by pain, and she suffered.
Oh, that day.
I wanted to go to a friend's house, called her to ask for permission, and
I can remember my mom kind of like snipping at her and saying things.
Basically said, do whatever you want, no one listens to me anyway.
I was like, well, maybe we'll go home and see what we can do. And I remember driving home, and when we made it home, I walked in the door.
My mom's music was blaring in the room.
There had been times where my mom had locked herself in her room, and honestly, there had been times where I shimmied my way in somehow to make sure she was okay. But that time felt different.
Knowing what I know now, the spirit told us to get out of there.
Walk away from the door, Sadie. Like, don't go in there.
Sadie and I left, and still to this day, I don't know if she was alive when we were there. I have no idea.
She actually had called me and insinuated some things that was going on. So I'll clean up my tools and I'm headed home. I could hear music playing, but I couldn't get in the bedroom. Finally figured out how to get in, and then that's when I found her. So I ended up calling 911. You know, they came over and took over from that point. And
when we turned the corner into our cul-de-sac of where our house was, there were ambulances, fire trucks, policemen lining the street. And the fear I saw in my sister's eyes.
Because, like, I had heard my mom threaten suicide in the past, I immediately thought, like, my mom did it. Like, is this the final straw, you know? Is my mom still with us or not? And I think the minute I pulled up and saw that, that's probably exactly what my face said, was like, mom's gone.
I've never fell to my knees and cried like that in my entire life. Having to learn that she chose to leave this world was the deepest pain. I felt like she was choosing to leave me. I was flooded with so many different emotions I didn't know how to handle. I remember thinking, I just need to go run. Let this go, run as fast as I can for as long as I can. Not run away from the situation, but like run to figure out what was going on. I started realizing that running was gonna be my rock. It was gonna be the thing that was always consistent in my life. So I started pushing myself. I started realizing that, man, I'm getting good at this. I like it. It keeps me busy. It makes me happy. Towards my senior year, I started pushing myself harder and realizing that college was an opportunity for me. No one in my family has gone to college, so it never struck me that I would go.
It makes me emotional to think about how Coach Taylor and the team, you know, supported the one person that I love the most. They would run together and support each other in a lot of different ways. And in some ways, that was just remembering her mom. That could be a ribbon, right? You know, that could be a prayer before a race.
We accepted Sarah, and the team accepted Sarah for who she was and where she was at in her journey. We all saw the potential in who she could become, and what she could do with the gift she was given, but never undermining her process and understanding she had a lot of hard days. But there were things that they would do behind the scenes to show a sense of support.
My junior year in college at Nationals was the best race of my entire life.
The top 40 receive All-American honors, and there's 250 athletes that line up on that national championship day.
Sarah's goal is to be an All-American, right? And that's what she was working towards. In order for them to achieve this goal, to be national champions as a team, and for Sarah to be a All-American as an individual, they're gonna have to go to the well. They're gonna have to leave it all out there on the course.
I love the expectation that she placed on herself, and I love that she wanted to be so accountable to that goal that she had to look me in the eyes and say it out loud. I'm going to be an All-American. That is the reason why she could race with the amount of grit that she races with, is because she has had to be tough, sometimes by choice and sometimes by default.
I just remember that was the first race that I felt my mom running with, or like carrying me. Like I felt my mom during that day, during the race.
And she passed out over the finish line. So she left it all out on the course, and it just made me so happy to be there as she lived that dream. And then of course, you know, winning the Nationals, yeah, that was a bonus.
It was amazing walking up to my dad and like looking at my dad in the eyes and like, Dad, I did it. And we were both crying because he supported me from when I was a kid all the way through my running career. And he was so proud of me, and I was so proud of myself. And it was an amazing day.
I'll never understand why people love to run, but I'm so glad that Sarah found it. Running is what made Sarah who she is, and I don't know who she would be without it. It's made her such a stronger person, but now that she's done with her BYU career, it's strengthened her in a lot of ways.
I mean, you take the national championship, and that's gonna be a little tiny piece over here now. And I mean, she'll always have that memory, and it's always gonna be fantastic, but now it's gonna be bigger. You know, the kids are gonna be, that's gonna be their world.
Becoming a mom makes me wonder what it was like for you. All the memories I am making are so exciting and new. I wonder if you experienced that too. I can't call to see what your pregnancies were like. I can only wonder if ours are alike. I'll treasure his wiggles in my tummy and think of how you are holding him above me.
Baby dad!
He knows my heartbeat as I knew yours. So hold him tight while you can, because in heaven he is yours. If your heartbeat is what connects us, then hold him to yours so you can continue to direct us. Our worlds are so far apart, and he makes the distance seem shorter. I just wish I could see you become his supporter. When he comes into this world, please give him a kiss goodbye, and be sure to sing him one last lullaby. I know you will miss him as he will miss you, so as his angel, guide him like grandmas do. Through everything that I've been through in my life, I have gained an understanding of who I am and who I can become, and it has opened my eyes to all the opportunities that are ahead of me. The process of healing is different for everyone, and we just have to trust in ourselves. We're stronger than we think. We can draw from inspiration that we didn't even know we had. And I just want to say to those people who have lost either a parent to suicide or a sibling or anything, that you're not alone. There's no words that I can say that will bring you comfort, except for you're not alone. And you can do this. You can become who you want to become. I'm living proof of that. And I'm so grateful that I was able to find joy.
What an unbelievable story. Sarah's determination and fight. Just a few of the many characteristics that helped make her a star both on and off the track during her time at Brigham Young University. We certainly wish her and her new family nothing but the best moving forward. We'll revisit the runners in just a bit, but first, now tee off on a Deep Blue Chronicle from the Links, another powerful story centering on BYU golfer Anik Hushkevich. Family is very much the foundation for Anik, who bonded with her father through the game of golf. It is that shared passion for the game that brought them together in new ways and also helped her push through the grief when her biggest fan was no longer by her side. This is Deep Blue.
My dad is from Poland. He was born and raised there.
My mom was born in Toronto, Canada.
My parents met on tour for Cirque du Soleil.
And my dad barely spoke any English. And my mom knew a little bit of Slovenian through her parents' roots.
And then there was a show in Vegas called Mystère. And they both got called in to be the original cast. And so that's kind of how our family started.
We always had family dinner together, which was, I feel like, so important to us as a family.
My sister would be at ballet, I would be at golf, we'd all be at school. Like, my brother was younger, so it's like, it was like one part of our day that we could all kind of connect, communicate, and kind of just like almost relax in a way over food.
It's very heartwarming, and I feel like it really showed how close we were as a family to be able to like have time to sit together and enjoy each other's company.
That's one thing I try to observe as a coach is, you know, how are you with your family? How do you treat your parents? Because most likely that's how you're gonna treat me. You could tell that they were close, and that's what I really respected and admired about her and her family is just that relationship. The fact that her family was important to her and that she wanted them involved in this process, you know, showed a lot about how close they are and just their interactions too.
I feel like my dad just always had such a passion for golf. I think that's really where they both like bonded and fell for their love for golf even more, because he had his partner, Anik, and Anik had someone to, you know, look up to and have a coach for her.
If you look through our phones or my phone, a coach videos me. She looks at my swing, I look at it, and then I send it to my dad. And sorry, it makes me emotional because I can't do that.
Such a, I don't, like, strong person. You, and then have them get cancer and someone that's healthy, it was just, it was really crazy.
It wasn't really talked about much. It's not something she liked to talk about. She got super emotional when we talked about it. And it was just like, okay, you know what I mean? Like, obviously that sucks.
When you do chemo, I think cold really affects your nerves. So it's like really hard for you to walk. And so my dad wasn't able to walk, obviously, all 18 holes, but he was able to be there on my 18th hole and see me win regionals, which, I mean, that kind of shows how tough he is as a man, because like you're going through such a hard time and you're able to go support your kids like that. I think it's really special.
There was so much uncertainty with everything, so I feel like it really brought us together, and it really showed how, like, it, we had that closeness before, but it really showed how important it was to all of us as a family once he was diagnosed.
So I've always wanted to play Riverside with my dad.
When she asked, I knew what that would mean to her.
It was almost as if we kind of knew in our heart that it'd be our last round.
So I was like, of course, you know what I mean? And you know, take a cart, here's lunch, you know?
I mean, I've played with my dad my whole life, and it was just like our thing together. Like, we loved playing golf together. It was 5 years of doing chemo and fighting cancer, and he just had to get that huge surgery of getting a colostomy bag, and he was able to sit in the cart and hit every shot, and he probably even shot in the 70s still. Like, to the last second, he was an incredible athlete.
I think after my dad passed away, she really didn't want to continue with golfing, because that was their thing.
No way in the world am I going to like leave my mom, my brother, and my sister right now and go play golf. My coach is super understanding. She's like,
you let me know what you want to do. I wanted to just give her options.
You know, at the end of the day, like, Tata, our dad, did want her to continue with golf, and I think that he, of course, is proud forever, like, for how far she got. I told her that, like, If you're gonna do it for yourself, but know that like Tata would want you to do it as well. And he's gonna be supporting you no matter what decision you make.
I kind of came to a realization of, yeah, why am I not going back? Like, almost like, why am I being kind of selfish and being like, oh, I need time. Like, no, like Tata, like in the nicest way, Tata wouldn't care. Like, you know, go play golf. That's what you committed to do for those 5 years. So like, why quit now, right? That was the day where I decided like, I'm going back and I'm gonna finish this year out and I'm gonna kind of make my dad proud and give him something to watch, you know, while he's up there and have him kind of support me one last time, but in a different way.
I just admire her so much with the amount of strength that she's shown through all of this. Like, I have so much love for her and admiration, and I'm just so grateful that I have a little sister like that to look up to, because she really means the absolute world to me.
Her resilience, I mean, Anique has always been such a fighter throughout everything that she's been through, just always staying focused on what she needs to get done, no matter what's going on. She just wants to put her best foot forward in everything that she does and just keep getting better.
She is our positive, bubbly energy, and she's our biggest cheerleader. She roots for everybody on the team, and she's vocal about it, and she lifts you up, and then on the course, I mean, she was awesome for us.
I used to get extremely nervous off the first tee, and I used to have like a really bad anxiety on the course. And I almost feel like now I have like this peace where I know my dad is there. I know he's watching me. I know he's giving me the good bounces. I know whatever outcome there is just like, I'm gonna be happy about it because I'm playing golf and because I feel close to my dad.
The bond between a parent and child is clearly one of the most powerful forces in the world, and Anique is very much playing for her dad to this day. Hushkevich finished the 2022 season as a member of the All-West Coast Conference first team. Still on the way, a legend in every sense of the word at BYU, Elaine Michaelis and her unmatched impact in women's sports for the Cougars. You're watching Deep Blue on BYU TV. A warm welcome back to this Deep Blue Women's special on BYU TV. And once again, we focus on an All-American runner. Enter Courtney Wayman, who actually dreamt of playing collegiate soccer as a young girl. When the choice came to either pursue that dream and play on a day she holds very sacred, or give up the sport entirely, Wayman stepped away from the game she loved and found another path. In her own words, a calling of sorts. She channeled her athletic gifts into a less publicized sport, that of the steeplechase. It was there she became a national champion and learned how to hurdle much more than just an obstacle in her race. This is Deep Blue.
There were thrills, too, at Aintree, where England's big race of the year, the Grand National Steeplechase, had more than its usual quota of spine-tingling, bone-bruising spills. Many started, few finished this grueling test of man and mount.
There was a race in Ireland from one city to another. They started from one church and ran to the next church. And they called it from steeple to steeple. So it was called the steeplechase. And as they ran that, they had to jump over fences and jump over rivers. Somewhere in the track world, somehow they decided on the steeplechase where they would make it a 3,000-meter race. There's 28 hurdles and 7 water jumps in this 7.5-lap race. If your arms and legs ache and you can't breathe, that's a good steeple.
Nice. The other little girl that she's running with right there is Courtney Wayman.
The goal was always to play college soccer.
It was apparent early on she loved a team and having that social connection. She found friends immediately on both sides of the field, like her teammates for sure, but her competitors, everyone knew who she was.
We had made a decision that I was not allowed to play soccer on Sundays, and we played a lot of soccer on Sundays. And so I had to sit a lot of those games, and my club had decided that that was no longer going to be a thing for them, that I either had to play soccer on Sundays or I wasn't allowed to play for the club at all.
And she said, no. And he said, then we don't have a spot for you on the team. And that was hard. I knew her heart. So courageous. I mean, I was stepping away. I just let her handle the phone call and...
I don't know why, I just didn't feel the fun. I didn't feel enjoyment anymore, and it felt time to move on. And so I decided, you know, I'm really good at running.
I had also felt in my heart, and I'd never said anything, that she was to be a steeplechaser.
It's so weird because I had a love for the event before I had even tried it. My first conversation with Coach Taylor, I just told her, she said, well, what event do you do? And I said, well, I'm a steepler. She goes, oh, have you ever run one? And I said, nope. She's like, well, then how do you even know? I'm like, I don't know. It's just what I've been told. I think it's just what I'm meant to do.
You're starting out, everybody's feeling good. You're going through life. It's kind of fun. You get wet on a hot day. It's awesome. And then when you get to the mile mark, you know you're in a race and it's tough and everybody's feeling the same thing. And that's when, you know, life's challenges kind of hit you right in the face and you got to decide, what am I going to do?
Seeing her succeed is absolutely wonderful. Seeing the difficulties in the trials is heartbreaking.
In February of 2018, I started to get like a little pain in my lower leg, just underneath my knee. When you're so set in on your dreams, pushing anything that could be a stumbling block, you'll kind of put it on the back burner and think that you're just tough. And it led to having to take 5.5 months off, which in the grand scheme of things was a longer time than had I just been a little bit smarter and spoken up a little sooner and tried to not be so greedy.
And that's hard to be patient. It's hard as a parent, and it's hard for her to, you know, because you always want to be at the top of your game.
You know, I felt like I really followed God's plan for me of choosing to run, and where was he now?
And she pondered quitting and just walking away from the sport. That was what was going through her head. And I remember having a midnight conversation with her, just basically saying, I'll wait, I will support you, I will not give up on you. And I didn't want her to give up on herself either.
I spent a lot of days on the floor of like my kitchen pleading with God to fix it, to fix something, to give me hope, to give me anything. And I felt like there was a lot of days of silence. And he was always there. It was just allowing me to have a moment of growth and really figuring out, like, you know, in those deep, dark days, who was I gonna turn to? Who was I gonna become? And how was I gonna get out of it? So the following year, I started to get a pain in my hip and I had that gut feeling that I talked about of like, this is a little bit more. I again decided that I was really tough and I could push through it. Again, it wasn't the smartest thing I could have ever done.
It was still 2 injuries. It was still 2 outdoor seasons gone. It was still 2 steeples.
And so she was really in this complex struggle within her own self, trying to find out, who am I outside of this sport? And is there a part to my personality and my passions outside of running? And I really think that summer she couldn't answer that question. So she was seeking identity outside the sport. And I support that 100%. What I don't support is giving up on the one thing you can't go a day without thinking about. And so I wasn't gonna let her do that.
Coach Taylor preaches a lot about gratitude and service, and that was kind of how I chose to live my time during that injury. I wasn't perfect by any means, and I understand that there was a lot of flaws in that.
I just decided that I would serve someone else, and if I couldn't reach my own goals, then I would help someone else. I was happy that I could be a piece of that. That brought me a lot of peace and solitude for being able to help someone else achieve their goals too.
The last lap is what everybody runs this race for. That's where the glory comes. Those who are the most efficient, those who seem to just do well, have done it because they've practiced. They've practiced the hard things. So the last lap is when you go through the hardest things, but you do them the best that you can do. And one of the most satisfying things there is to make it over the last water jump and run it well.
Not every race is a good race, and not every season's a good season. It has ups and downs, as does anything in life. But when you give that thing and attach your worth to that thing, you're only as good as the outcome.
Courtney in 2021 was favored to win the NCAA championship in the steeplechase. She got injured in the prelims, and she had a tough race. She was right there at the very end. With 300 meters to go, she was, you know, in the lead and had a bad water jump and just couldn't, you know, just couldn't recover and make up that and ended up fourth. And I think that fourth place finish in her NCAAs really helped her see things differently rather than, wow, you know, I was favored to win and I wanted to win, but, you know, my body and health and such was just in a place that it was really tough. She came back and ended up fourth in the Olympic trials. That fourth place trophy is one of the most things I'm proud of, is to watch what it helped her see and become.
You know, if you're telling yourself like, oh, this is a bad season, so now I'm a bad person, or oh, I'm bad this, or this portion of me is bad because of this outcome, you're giving that thing power. Whereas if you know that your worth is tied to who you are and the person that you're growing to become and hoping to become and trying to be and giving your best, when you have a bad outcome, you can say, oh, well, that sucks. I wish it would have gone better, but I'm still awesome. But let's figure out a way to make the outcome better next time.
She went on to win 4 national championships and set an NCAA record, but that was a tough day for her. And how she responded to that is just her own doing.
If I had just not ran the greatest race, might not be the first thing on my mind to go tell everybody else good job. And even like if you win or you run a great race, like your first instinct's gonna be to celebrate and to go like hug and celebrate with the people that you care about. But she's always the first to make sure that everybody else feels like they at least have at least her to celebrate with if maybe they don't have someone else that's celebrating with them for what they did.
It makes me proud and happy and amazed. Amazed really is probably a good word to use for that. Amazed at who she is at the end of the day, who Courtney Wayman is.
Between all the highs and the lows, I think it's allowed me to find my worth and find joy and faith on the journey. And the journey's not all sunshine and butterflies and rainbows, but it makes the journey easier. You see the sunshine and the butterflies better when you've gone through the really hard things.
Courtney Wayman is yet another inspiring example of running forward with faith and hope in the midst of trials and setbacks. Safe to say that Wayman and every other athlete at BYU have seen or heard the name Elaine Michaelis at some point in their BYU careers. So it's fitting that we close out this Deep Blue special with a woman who probably deserves more than just the title of special. Elaine Michaelis was a true pioneer whose legacy at BYU lasers in on opening doors, especially for female athletes. It is not hyperbole to say that every single one of BYU's highly successful women's sports programs have been influenced for the better by the sacrifices and efforts of Elaine Michaelis. Let's go, Deep Blue.
Some people think that my claim to fame is my no-hitter and one-hitter in the same day. It was just a blessing, that's all. We just had a great team behind us, and we could hit the ball as well. Sports was in our family, much to my mother's dismay. She thought I ought to just be sewing and doing the usual lady things. I did some of those, but also I worked in my dad's feed store. Guys in the feed store every morning would check the scores, and I had my favorite, which were the Red Sox, as well as we had a good church program for softball. So I grew up doing sports.
Well, I went to BYU at about the same time that Elaine went to school. We traveled through those classes together. And of course, Lou was working at that time and teaching, so I knew her as an instructor.
They didn't really ask me to be in charge of women's athletic. I was basically asked to just keep track of what was going on. Well, sports days for the women were just let's get together and play another school.
sometimes would go to Colorado, then you'd compete for one day, intermingle, play, and then you, that was your season, and then you were finished.
And that's kind of what we did. We had maybe a few days of practice. The coaches were our faculty members who used their cars to get us to where we're going. And we compete all day long and then call it a day and go home. It was a fun competition, but it wasn't elite competition. We were competing with the best we had.
They must have been incredibly patient as they tried to bring people along with the concept that women really deserve the right to participate at the highest levels.
Having to work around the men's program and their extensive opportunities, the focus was on them mostly.
Well, we, of course, were delighted to have a passage of the Title IX that would give us an opportunity to compete nationally and would also expand women's sports.
Title IX required certain requirements to be considered competition that is worthy of what a school should have. And so almost all the schools had to make some adjustments to make sure the women got the same opportunities as the men.
They asked the question, why didn't the women practice and play in the Marriott Center since it was available? And they were told that the women didn't want to, which was completely untrue. No one contacted the women. It was the male athletic director that answered the questions concerning the women.
Of course, at that time, we were not very much in compliance. It took us a while to work through it.
Her patience, her persistence was really critical in bringing BYU to where it is today.
Whether she was either the coach of it or then later on as the athletic director, she was responsible for bringing in so many more opportunities for women's sports.
She propelled women's sports forward by just being our advocate.
So if the football team was getting something, then, well, the girls should deserve to get kind of the same type of treatment. She just kind of demanded that we were treated fairly.
She was there just supporting us in everything that we did, wanting us to be successful, wanting all sports to be successful, especially for the women. And she just really did, I think, all that she could to make sure that we got the recognition that we deserved.
Someone had to do it. Elaine and I were the only ones available. And so we did what we thought we needed to do to build women's sports and to promote it.
I know that when Elaine first started, she was coaching five or six sports early on in her coaching career. But I know that later on, it eventually just focused on volleyball and she specialized in volleyball.
Well, it just evolved. I didn't really make a choice. Its schedules became conflicted, so something had to go. Other people came in to help with the coaching and took over some of the sports.
She just went about doing what you need to do to be successful. And she would teach people. She was a teacher. She wasn't a yeller. She would help people understand the concepts and what they were trying to achieve. And she would work hard and just go about it in a loving way.
Clean the floors, you know, sweep them down, set up the nets, whatever needed to be done, she just did it because that's what needed to happen. Never drawing attention to herself, never, I think, with any agenda.
You know, she reached the pinnacle of her profession in the coaching world and then just naturally assumed this responsibility as leading the women's programs. And back then, as now, BYU's women's programs were among the best in the country. And a lot of that can be tied back to Elaine's time, you know, as a coach and as an advocate for women's sports, and then eventually as the director of women's athletics.
The women on our team have the honor and privilege to play on Elaine Michaelis' court.
And although they didn't get to play for her, we always try to bring out the stories and the history and the tradition that Coach Michaelis laid before our teams.
When Elaine retired, there were only four programs that had been to more NCAA tournaments than BYU. Coach of the Year some dozen times. Her overall career, she won almost 80%, 79 point something percent of her overall matches. But I think her relationships that she built was as strong as her schematics and her X and O's of her coaching, is that she knew how to bring people together and help them achieve goals and teach them how to be successful.
At the recent alumni luncheon that we had, I was able to meet a woman who played in the very first year that Elaine played. And I was privileged to be one of those who played in the last year that she played. And just to see a 40-year legacy and 40-year span of what she's been able to do was really special. And I'm just really happy that they put her name on that court to recognize that.
President Hinckley used to say that people needed to be well-bred and well-dead before they had a name on a building or something at BYU. And so that shows how much esteem people have for Elaine Michaelis. In order to get your name on a facility here, you have to be someone of the highest esteem. And Elaine certainly fits that in every way.
We want our recruits and our players to understand just how powerful and impactful their opportunity to put on a BYU jersey and play on Elaine Michaelis court is for them and what that represents to the world.
I don't think BYU would be what it was without her hard work and dedication and just her love for what she was doing. I think every one of us are grateful and would just say thank you.
Everything you've done for BYU and the BYU women's volleyball team will never be forgotten. Everything we have, we owe to you. And we hope that we can just be a small part of continuing on your legacy and continue to make you proud by what we're doing on and off the court.
I thank you from the bottom of my heart for being the one to give me an opportunity to come here. Coming here really shaped who I am as a person, and I feel like guided me for everything else that I've done in the rest of my life, being a mother, being a coach, great mentor for me, and just the way that my life has gone. So I thank you for that.
You know, I don't know. It just evolved. I was blessed with some talents and opportunities and enjoyed them. And I think when you're having fun and you're enjoying what you're doing, it just perpetuates itself.
I've been fortunate to interact with Elaine personally on several occasions and have called many matches on Elaine Michaelis court. She exudes joy, kindness, and charity and fought so hard for equality, a hero in every sense of the word for BYU athletics. As we close out, a reminder to watch more inspirational stories like the ones we just heard and watched by visiting byutv.org/deepblue, or you can simply scan the barcode on the screen right now. Our thanks to Heather Hampson, Sarah Musselman, Anik Hushkevich, Courtney Waymont, and Elaine Michaelis for sharing their stories, and a big thank you for joining us on this Deep Blue special. For every member of our outstanding crew here at BYU TV, I am Spencer Linton. We'll see you next time.